Welcome to Living Healthy Together. Each week we share patient stories, advice and insights from those closest to care, dive into health-related current events, and explore the local and national issues shaping healthcare across our region. I'm your host, Philip Rao, with University of Vermont Health.
We got the call, and I remember I had no idea what an AVM was or what he was really saying. But when you're told you're going to meet with a neurosurgeon the next week, it hits that this is not a little problem. And I remember sitting there talking to Kian about what this meant.
At 6'3", Kian Ruid of Williston, Vermont, is a student athlete of impressive stature and skill. A junior at Champlain Valley Union High School, where he plays varsity hockey, Kian's life was turned upside down nearly 2 years ago by a rare abnormality in his brain known as an arteriovenous malformation, or AVM, a dangerous tangle of blood vessels that causes headaches, pain, vision problems, and more, as well as posing serious risks for internal bleeding resulting in seizures, stroke-like symptoms, cognitive difficulties, movement problems, and other life-changing impacts. For Kian, headaches caused by the AVM were so powerful that standing upright quickly became unbearable. Once the Ruids learned more about what was behind them, and doctors found the AVM entangled with the motor center of Kian's brain, surgery quickly became an imperative. Today on Living Healthy Together, we'll talk with Kian and his mother, Rebecca, about their family's experience dealing with this mysterious, sudden, and debilitating condition, and Kian's remarkable recovery and path back to the ice. We'll also take an inside look at the system of care and support that serves patients like Kian with Dr. Katrina Dusis, the only pediatric neurosurgeon in Vermont and the person who removed the AVM from Kian's brain. Kian and Rebecca, thanks for being with us today. About a year ago now, you both were dealing with circumstances, challenges, and decisions that probably made almost everything else feel irrelevant, and it came out of nowhere. Kian, do you remember how it all started?
I think she knows a lot more behind the scenes than I do. I remember my major symptom was a headache that would really only affect me when my torso was upright, so when I was sitting or standing. So I was basically bed rest for like 2 weeks, and I couldn't go to school. I also had a hockey game that weekend, and that was very hard to play in, obviously, when you can't really stand up without your head aching. So that was the initial symptom. We got an MRI 2 Fridays from then, I believe, and that was kind of like the whole start of this process.
It was somewhat of a short timeline from when the first symptom came. It was March 2nd, and Kian was actually babysitting for some neighbor's kids when we went to a friend's birthday party and had said that he had a headache and was laying down. His brother gave him a hard time because he said that he did more of the babysitting than Kian did because Kian was laying down the whole time, and Kian was explaining to us that he had a raging headache, which is not anything he's ever complained about before. And the next day was when he had his hockey game. So that was on a Sunday. And we went to Norwich. It was the state championship, I believe. And Kian woke up with a headache and lay down the whole drive to Norwich. And I was like, this is really weird. We had tried to give him some medicine. I, of course, had a Diet Coke with me and was like, here, have some of this. I think that could help your headache. And didn't seem to make any difference, but he really wanted to play. And he was actually skating out to face-offs at a complete angle, like just bent in half, skating out to face-off. And my friend and I were like, this is weird and can't be great. And he would come to the bench, and I saw after his first shift, his coach wanted to put him right back in. I saw Kian shake his head no, which is unlike Kian, who never wants to come off the ice. And about 3/4 of the way through the game, he pulled himself out of the game and was done and didn't go back out to skate. Came out into the parking lot after changing and just lay down on the sidewalk outside the rink and was like, my head just is killing me. So we went home. We did call the doctor's office that night because I was like, this just seems really acute, and it would be completely gone when he was laying down. He was totally fine. And they just sort of said, give him some ibuprofen, give it some time, let's see. And Kian then spent the next week laying down. He couldn't go to school. He couldn't be up for more than maybe 10 minutes at a time. He would come downstairs to eat and then would complain of a headache and go back up to lay down. But while laying down, he does BYU math online. And he was doing all of his math. So cognitively, he was fine. He was motivated. He wanted to do it, but just couldn't be upright. So it was actually, working at the hospital, I work with a lot of different providers, primary care providers, various nurses and educators. And I was talking about his symptoms and they would all look at each other silently. And I would say, I can see you. I see you looking at each other. This is not making me feel okay. And they were all insistent that we do something urgently. They're like, this is not a normal headache. This doesn't sound typical. It's really concerning. So we ultimately went and we did his first MRI that Friday. And I feel so bad for the tech because we were like singing and in a great mood and happy because we were going to Montreal for a Canadiens game that night. We were leaving to go to a game the next day. And she, I'm sure, saw the scan and said, did your doctor want you to stay here until they called you? And I was like, no. I'm sure they'll call sometime next week. We're good. Thanks so much. And sort of went skipping out of there. And we hadn't even gotten home. And the doctor on call called to let us know that we'd be meeting with the neurosurge team the next week.
Kian, is there a way to put a frame around it for folks? What it was like going through this, not just during the game, but then for an entire week, not being able to stand up?
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely a lot worse than any headaches I've had in the past. I've never really had a migraine, but I would imagine it was something like a migraine. And at times, I could laugh out of it, just having my head down always was kind of like a strange behavior, obviously. It's just hard to like focus and play in that headache. Like I had to like take really short shifts and just get to the bench and put my head down. It takes a lot of your focus away. It was hard. That part was hard. Missing school sucked, not being able to see my friends. It was only a week, which is a long time, but it didn't feel too bad. Being in bed for a week, I got homework done still. I was able to stay mostly on top of stuff. And my teachers throughout this whole process were amazing at keeping me like on track and letting me miss stuff I didn't need to take. Teachers helped a lot, so school wasn't really a big issue and supportive at home. So it wasn't bad.
What went through your minds when you got that call that you're going to be meeting with the neuro team?
It was on speakerphone, so she had like it held up to her ear, and just like the emotion from her was obviously not positive. And I think she started crying, which always worries me. So there was just like a lot of stress and worry about it.
I think in my head, because interestingly, his headache had gone away the night before the MRI, but we had followed through with it just because gut instinct was something was wrong. But I thought everything was going to be fine. I thought, oh, he must have just had a virus or some odd thing. And we got the call, and I remember I had no idea what an AVM was or what he was really saying. But when you're told you're going to meet with a neurosurgeon the next week, it hits that this is not a little problem. I remember getting teary, but trying to keep it together because I didn't want Kian to panic and I didn't really understand what does this mean and what is this going to look like. And so I just didn't want to freak him out by me falling apart. So when we got home, my husband was, I think, in a work meeting and I called two of my closest friends and just broke down and asked, you know, what would you do? We're supposed to leave this afternoon for Montreal. I don't want to just sit at home and worry about it, but what if something goes wrong? So they really kind of talked me through what made sense for our family and helped me breathe.
What did you guys end up doing? Did you go on your trip?
We went to Montreal, which was definitely really fun. We went and we saw some hockey. We saw them practice and we saw them play. I love cities, so it was a fun trip for me. Obviously, like that lingering thing was negative, but able to kind of like push past it a little bit because we didn't know too much about it.
We went and we had done a bunch of research on hospitals nearby because after I talked to my friends on the phone, I did call some colleagues and ask what we would need to do. And everybody said you would need to go immediately to an emergency room, and we were within a mile of a really good hospital in Montreal, so we figured we could get care there and may as well go and have a good time and catch some hockey. And I remember sitting there during their practice and talking to Kian about what this meant and that he might not be able to be playing hockey over the summer or at other times. And he was just like, no, I'm playing. It's not an option.
I didn't really know the seriousness of it until after the surgery itself, where it was like 5% chance or something I wouldn't be able to move the right side of my body. But I was just like assuming that the other 95% would just be, I'm fine and can like walk out of there and stuff. I didn't really understand that even if it does go well, there will still be that whole recovery process and all that stuff will still happen.
It seems like this all happened so fast. Did things continue to move fast once you got back from Montreal?
Over the next month, I had all different types of scans, stuff like that. It was like a month, month and a half. March 29th, I had surgery. So yeah, over that month, there was lots of meetings, lots of medical intervention. I wasn't really going to school. There was this tournament that my dad put the team together for. And obviously, I couldn't play. So I just went there and coached. And it was nice to be with my friends. There was talk when we were in Montreal about getting the surgery that week. I remember saying, because I was expecting that if I got surgery that week, that I would be able to play the hockey games that weekend, which obviously was very far off.
Take a quick break here on Living Healthy Together. When we come back, we'll continue the conversation with Kian and Rebecca. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Living Healthy Together, where we're diving into pediatric neurosurgery and the medical journey of Kian Ruud, a student athlete and hockey player who about 2 years ago was suddenly faced with a rare abnormality in his brain known as AVM, a dangerous tangle of blood vessels that put him at risk for a wide variety of health impacts and ultimately required surgery to remove. Kian, before we went to break, you were talking about this month-long period of diagnostic testing and planning that happened before your surgery, and how you dealt with debilitating headaches that dramatically impacted your ability to go to school, play sports, and simply stand upright. What do you remember most from that time? Were you able to keep life normal at all?
The headaches, they weren't really there. Like, there was like some difference I could feel and stuff. I was trying to go to school. If I got overly fatigued or something, my head could start to hurt. So at the school nurse office, I'd go lay down there. So, I mean, I was trying to get back to life as normal. I always liked to work out, but high blood pressure would cause it to burst, so I wasn't allowed to work out anymore. While we were in Montreal, I wasn't allowed to go in the hot tub at the hotel. It was very cold, so that was disappointing, but no matter how much stress I had, it wouldn't really change it. And life went on like kind of normal, minus the physical activity stuff and a couple other things, but it went on pretty normal. I definitely talked to my friends about it, and everybody I was in class with knew about it then. Like, so that was definitely nice. At that point, hockey was over. I didn't really have much going on outside of school. So that really became this big thing of going to the hospital multiple times a week for meetings or stuff like that, and just like constant news. So that definitely became just something outside of my life that obviously wasn't great.
Rebecca, we've been getting your perspective and Kian's, obviously, but this is something that impacted your entire family. How did they deal with what Kian was going through?
Kian's dad, my husband, is JC. He was involved in all of this every day, all day as well. We were having lots of conversations and certainly trying to have them away from Kian. Time seemed to move super fast and super slow at the same time. So it was a lot of what felt like waiting, but we were having to do a ton in that time. And then Kian also has a younger brother, Ty, who is now 14, who also plays hockey. He's a goalie, but is a horseback rider. And so we were really lucky. He spent a lot of time at the barn with what we call our barn family. And everybody, we have lots of friends and social connections in Vermont. Our friends all knew what was going on, and everybody was incredible and supportive and available for everything that we needed. Really, I mean, I found that Dr. Doucis was that as well. She was an incredible support. When we talked on the phone on that Friday and found out about the AVM and that we were meeting with a neurosurgeon, my understanding is we were meeting with her on Monday. And Monday, midday, we still hadn't heard. So I called the office and they said, oh, no, she's out of town. She's not meeting with you today. We were going to call you at some point when she gets back to schedule a time for her to meet with you. And I was like, I know that this is not your fault at all. And it was clearly misunderstanding or miscommunication, but we have no idea what we should be doing or next steps. And amazingly, I got a call back an hour later that she was going to be at a layover at Chicago O'Hare and was happy to meet with us televideo. So she popped on and was able to kind of give us more information about what an AVM is, what Kian's specifically looked like. And she scheduled us to do an MRA the next day at the hospital. So, and then meet with her in person. So all of that happened pretty quickly, but felt like it was forever.
There's so much going on in your lives at this point and these big decisions facing you and JC and Kian. How did you decide where the surgery would be performed and who would do it?
Yeah, we were still some steps away. JC wanted to consult, understandably so, with somebody else. So our primary care had connected us with Boston. And so we actually had a phone consult with an expert in AVMs. He actually has written the protocols and done a bunch of things. And he was wonderful, laid out pretty identically to what Dr. Doucis had laid out, what the thinking was, what the intervention would likely be, prognosis, all of those things. And then really, JC and I had to decide, do we stay locally and use Dr. Doucis, who I really liked and felt connected with and felt confident in, or do we go to Boston, which is a bigger facility with more access to specialty things, but would require uprooting our family, including Kian's brother, pulling him out of school. And ultimately, we decided to go with Dr. Doucis, much with the support from Boston, honestly. They were like, she's one of the best. I don't know why you would go elsewhere. And her bedside manner and the way that she talked about Kian, to us, meant the world to me. And I just had a gut feeling that this is the person that should be doing it. So then he, on March 18th, had an angiogram, which I admittedly was a mess for. Kian and my husband have since made lots of fun of me. I was sobbing inconsolably as they were wheeling Kian off for the procedure. And JC was like, you can't do that. You're going to scare him. Like, I'm not choosing to do this. It was awful. And I think it's really noteworthy. Dr. Johnson, people have said he's pretty straight-laced. He likes his OR to be the way he likes it to be. He usually listens to classical music. He's kind of in control of that space. They don't typically do, you know, peds practice. And so I guess he had asked Kian what music he wanted to listen to during the angiogram. And Kian is now embarrassed about it because his musical tastes have changed, but they listened to Eminem for the entire procedure.
Was it classic Eminem or was it new stuff?
I don't know. I'd say for most of it, but yeah.
But it was so nice because talking to the team when they came out from the angiogram, I apologized for Kian's musical taste. And they were like, it actually took what was a very heavy, scary moment and made it feel lighthearted in the OR. And we were all singing along and really we found a good groove with it. So that was pretty cool. And interestingly, you know, life was going on. So Kian was still doing school. He was still doing his math online. That same day that he had the angiogram, his Governor's Institute application was due. He wanted to do a summer math camp through the Governor's Institute. So life was kind of going on. And right after the angiogram, Dr. Deuces coordinated with Dr. Johnson the surgery date of the 29th. Boston contacted us just to check in and follow up on what we were going to be doing. And they took a 180 on what they had recommended and suggested that we do more evaluation and maybe we want to consider radiation, which as a parent completely, I lost my balance because I felt so clear on what we were going to be doing. And then to hear maybe we shouldn't be doing that. So I called Dr. Deuces. She suggested that we do an fMRI just to get a look at what the risk factors were in doing the procedure. And she said it didn't change her opinion that no matter what was going to happen, it was too risky not to do a resection, but at least this could potentially offer some comfort in feeling like it was going to be a little safer if Kian's brain had reorganized slightly since he had had this since birth. So we did the fMRI and she called and was thrilled with the results and was like, everything moved, just that slight, slight bit around his AVM that I feel really confident that we can get it out without him being paralyzed. So at that point, we completely committed to doing the surgery on the 29th.
Mm-hmm. Kian, you seem like a really understated person. What was it like being thrust into a position where now this huge decision, maybe the most important decision of your life, is being made? Did that come home to you in that moment?
That thought definitely did cross my mind. I knew my parents were the ones making the decision, so obviously that took a lot of it off me. Probably sucked for them, but it took a lot of it off me. Throughout this whole process, I was just, I was trying to kind of like forget about it when I could and not make it as big of a deal as I guess it truly was, but like just trying to very understate it in my head, I guess is what happened, where I was just like living life mostly normal. This stuff was going on. I didn't really think too much of it because I was trying to think that it wasn't in my control whether or not like this went well or not. So just to try and be okay with that.
Rebecca, what was it like for you and JC to be faced with this situation as parents?
It was awful. I wish there was a different way to feel about it, but it was terrifying. I think that Dr. Deuces' clarity around, and Boston, ultimately the neurosurgeon there, confirmed if we were to just ask his opinion and not the entire team, he agreed with Dr. Deuces. The choice was kind of made for us. In many regards, Kian also does a great job of saying what he wants to be a part of and what he doesn't. So he had been really clear. He did not want to make the decision. He wanted us to make the decision for him. I was, happy to take off of his plate. I think understated is the right word for Kian, because Kian was sleeping in bed with me during this entire time from when his headache came on until surgery, and maybe be embarrassed, Kian, for that to be on the podcast, but it was more of I forced him to because we weren't sure if he was having seizures and he was on Keppra in order to make sure he didn't have seizures. But I just wasn't going to sleep if he wasn't right next to me and I wasn't able to know he was okay. And I did not sleep well during that month. And there would be occasions that Kian would wake up. I think the night before surgery was the most emotional of all of them. And now I'm going to get emotional, but where Kian woke up and talked about wanting to write a letter to Ty, his brother, in case he didn't make it. All the things he wanted to say to him.
We're going to take a break here on Living Healthy Together. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back with more from Kian and Rebecca. Welcome back to Living Healthy Together, where we're exploring the impact of pediatric neurosurgery through the story of Kian Ruid, a student athlete whose life was turned upside down by a rare brain abnormality known as AVM. Kian, you and your mom were just talking about the night before your surgery at UVM Medical Center. Take us through the day of the surgery from your perspective. What do you remember?
I didn't sleep well that night. And I had to be there, I believe, at 6 to get anesthesia. So we left at like 5:30. I was just so tired that I couldn't like really have the emotional aspect of it. Because, I mean, I was just like half asleep in the car ride there. And just like walking through the hospital, I was really just tired was the biggest thing. But I do remember when I saw the room, because they did an angiogram before the actual surgery. I was out for all of it. But when I walked into the room with the angiogram, something kind of clicked. Weirdly, like then that's when I realized how real it was. That's when then the emotions started hitting. But I was put under pretty quickly. So that part wasn't much for on my part. It was really just getting there.
Rebecca, what do you remember from that morning?
I remember it in vivid detail, all of it. I didn't have the luxury of being sedated. Our family uses humor as a way of coping with hard things. And this was one situation that we sort of were able to tap into that humor the night before. We were able to laugh about things, but the morning of, it was gone. Like, there was just no way to do that. We had to get there really early in order for him to get anesthesia. Everything goes through the comfort zone in the peds world. So fortunately, I know that whole team from working here, and we had already worked with them a few times. They also gave Kian something to calm down a little bit. I mean, he was calm, but incredibly anxious. You know, we had our last goodbye to him before surgery, and JC had said to me beforehand, he's like, you can't fall apart like you did before. That is something I cannot promise you. I will do my absolute best not to completely collapse or to keep it together until they get Kian out. But what's going to happen is going to happen. It was a long day. I mean, I feel like from saying goodbye to Kian until when Dr. Deuces came out to tell us it was successful was 10 hours. We had updates. Dr. Deuces came out each time Dr. Johnson had done a piece of what he was doing. He was doing an embolization, and there were three specific arteries that he was embolizing. And so she came out after each one to say one down, two to go, and just to kind of squat down next to my chair and check in. And then while she was doing her part of it, we got a phone call every hour from her nursing team in the OR to let us know how it was going. JC and I have very different ways of coping. So he wanted to walk and go get some fresh air and do things. And I just sat in the same chair in the waiting room and did not want to talk or move or do anything. In fact, I was looking at a plant the whole time that was a super cool plant. And I remember thinking, okay, if all this goes okay, I'm going to find that plant and get that plant. And so we actually now have that plant. I bought it someplace. We have that plant at home and it's growing beautifully. So that was the day of, and the phone call stopped 2 hours before surgery was done. When Dr. Deuces came out, I tackled her. When she said he's okay, I literally just jumped on her and hugged her and started crying and, you know, said, you guys didn't call. And so then I started to panic. And she said, well, yeah, because that's the most intense part of the whole day is wrapping up and closing him up. I'm sorry. She was so apologetic. And I was like, you don't have to say sorry. I get it. But it was a long time. And she said we could go right to the PICU to see Kian, but that we should probably go and clean ourselves up a little bit before we went to see him. And she actually right away also told us that she had left a little piece of the AVM that was deep in his motor center. And she had left it intentionally. It was really deep in there. She was worried about paralysis and believed that if she was accurate, that she had missed that piece, that it was going to be the right size for radiation, that would be a better approach to deal with that portion of it.
And what do you remember about waking up in the PICU?
The first night, maybe first two nights, the first night, I think the nurse came in every hour. And that's like flashlight in my eyes, make sure I was still like awake and all that stuff. I remember that she would ask me questions. I think I was really far off on the date, like comically. So that part I remember, like just being in the hospital bed. The right side of my body was completely numb and limp. Like I couldn't move it at all. Like I couldn't even wiggle a finger on the right side of my body. So I was really just in bed. And I can move left on my body to to do stuff, eat, set myself up, that stuff. But I was really just like a dead body there.
Was that something that Dr. Deuces and her team had prepared you for? Was it something normal that you were expected to have to recover from?
Yeah, so that was normal. And it was definitely something that I had to recover from. That's what I was saying, though, with like, I thought I was just going to be fine. But in the next week, I just kind of went by, kind of lying in bed, working on some of the motor function things. I was then able to get up a little bit, not really walk too well, but like I was able to get up, stand up, go to the bathroom, change myself, and like eat all that stuff. So then I was like able to do a decent amount, which was nice.
Dr. Deuces had done a good job explaining that he probably wouldn't be able to move the right side of his body because this was squarely sitting there on his brain. And she actually said that when they were closing him up, they saw his leg twitch and everybody cheered because she said, I know he can move. He just has lost kind of his sensory ability to do that. Kian did a phenomenal job. He's now like 6'4", but he was probably 6'1", 6'2" at the time. And so up on Baird 5, the nurses were definitely intimidated because he couldn't walk on his own and had no balance. So he needed to have somebody on each side supporting him to walk. I think that that was understandably nerve-wracking for them. And Kian is also somebody that thinks he can do things, whether that is accurate or not. So he would just go to decide he was going to get out of bed to go to the bathroom, even though he was unable to walk. So it definitely stressed the staff who were used to much smaller peds patients. So that was interesting. And that actually led to him. He needed to go to rehab in order to learn to walk again and to use the right side of his body. And there's not a pediatric facility in the state of Vermont for that. So this is where his size played in his favor, is they were willing to admit him with lots of requests from various friends and colleagues. They admitted him to Fannie Allen, which is an adult rehab facility. And he was there for a week with phenomenal care and left being able to walk and mostly use his right hand and just made significant gains when there, and then has worked with a neuro PT in the community twice a week and went to a speech language pathologist to work on some of the cognitive pieces. We had a full neuropsych eval done just to take a look at what this had impacted and what supports in school might be helpful. So that's kind of been the long path of recovery.
We're jumping over quite a bit here at the end, but you've made it all the way back now. You're playing hockey again. That's quite a remarkable recovery. Was there anything that surprised or really challenged you during your recovery?
So I was definitely really driven. After 3 months, I was cleared to play hockey and go back to full contact, full everything. And like past surgery, I got back on the ice for just a stick and puck thing. And it was really hard because like I could barely skate. Definitely couldn't like skate at like a hockey level. It was very emotional because I was expecting it to be a lot better than it was. So that kind of set the starting point for it, which was pretty low. And then just getting on the ice as much as I could, getting back to like working out my right ankle in hockey on skates, like having a weak ankle is very hard. So I did a lot of ankle stability over like that next year or something. And then 9 months in was the hockey trials for high school. So I made the team, which was amazing. It was a very hard recovery to get back to sports. And especially when I'm tired, there's definitely lingering symptoms. Hockey shows it the most. I feel like I'm trying to find a balance between acknowledging that this happened and taking that into consideration, and still living the life I want and not having this just holding me back. Because my parents have a lot of time told me whenever I've been mad about hockey that like I've had this happen, and I just have the mentality that it really doesn't matter because it doesn't. Just trying to like move on and do well in school and in hockey and all that stuff, but still realize that this happened.
We're going to take a break here on Living Healthy Together. When we come back, we'll meet pediatric neurosurgeon Dr. Katrina Dusis and talk about the system of care and treatment that supports patients like Kian. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Living Healthy Together. We're joined now by Dr. Katrina Dusis, a pediatric neurosurgeon and associate professor at Lerner College of Medicine. Dr. Dusis, thanks for being with us today. Let's start with Kian's case and what it's like for you as a surgeon performing a rare operation like this with the added complexity of where the AVM was located in Kian's brain.
They are all their own little unique challenges. You kind of just open up your day. You don't really want to do anything after one of these because you are so mentally exhausted by it. These, all of them, are fragile, friable blood vessels. And if you poke one the wrong way, you're spending 10 minutes trying to make it stop bleeding. And if you really poke it the wrong way, you better hurry up and take that thing out and hope you don't hurt anything on the way out. Just being super meticulous. And then I very much knew that a portion of this is in the motor region. And that's where I have to be extra careful. So sometimes you do that first, sometimes you save it for last. For him, I think I actually did more of the non-important part first, just so then when I got to the motor area, everything else was a little bit decompressed, so I had less manipulation of his brain there. There's a general guideline of, you know, you're done taking out the AVM when, and that's a twofold thing. Number one, when the draining vein or the blood vessel that's receiving all of the blood becomes slack and dark. So that had happened. And then number two, when there's no more bleeding, you can poke around a little bit and nothing else bleeds. That's how you know it's out. And so I had both of those situations with Kian. But what we know is that the gold standard is not what does the surgeon see at the end of the operation. The gold standard is having a post-op blood vessel study where we actually shoot dye directly into the blood vessels that we care about. And we found that the Kian had a residual. And that happens at 10% of kids, actually. That was a little disappointing from my perspective, but knowing that I had already made him partially weak and that I didn't see anything else abnormal inside of his brain, going back and doing another resection for something that I would struggle to find and potentially hurt him certainly wasn't something I was planning on. And so there's something called stereotactic radiosurgery. So there's one tiny spot that needed to be obliterated, and that's what this is good for. And so that's why he ended up having that last treatment to make the entire AVM go away. The other thing that's important about that is if you don't make it all go away, then the risk of bleeding isn't all gone either. And these things, they're parasites. They can actually regrow and take over more blood vessels. And so you've got to kill the whole thing. So it was unique in that I followed the rules and all these things should have said it was all gone, but you have to check and it wasn't. And so he got one last treatment and now it really is all gone.
That's a very sinister way to describe this thing. That gives me chills.
Yeah, they totally are. They totally parasitize and will continue to pick up more vessels.
Let's spend a second on Kian's recovery and him making a varsity hockey team 9 months after having had major surgery in the motor center of his brain. Even in a story that's not short on remarkable, that's pretty impressive.
Kids have this intrinsic ability and desire to get better. And so because of that, that was the time to take care of it. There's a term called neuroplasticity, and that if there's an insult to part of your nervous system, there's a golden area of improvement. If you have it too young, if you have an in utero insult, you're not recovering from that. If you're 30, 30-year-olds still have a little pixie dust on them. But there's this super happy area between ages 1 and 5 in my brain. And I'm sure somebody who's a neuroscientist has a way more scientific answer than that. But the younger you are, but you can't be too young, you have this ability to regenerate. 14's a little bit old, but I knew that there was going to be some of that. And so that was also one of the many reasons to do surgery sooner than later. Number one, to get rid of his risk of having a hemorrhage and having a long-term problem. But number two, that he had this intrinsic ability to regenerate even if there was a neurologic injury, which is exactly what he's done. And some of that's intrinsic. He's also done a lot of sweat equity. That kid has done a ton of therapy, did inpatient therapy, and really worked hard. And because of his sweat equity as well, that's why he's so stinking functional despite having a bad brain problem.
What goes into planning and executing a sequence of care and treatment like Kian's? It's very easy to focus on just the 10-hour surgical procedure and say, that's the care. But that's so far from the truth, especially in this case where Kian actually underwent a different surgery in his brain prior to your operation.
Being a neurosurgeon is like the cherry on top of this gigantic sundae. And that Sunday involved other neurosurgeons, my adult colleagues sometimes who are better at doing things than I am, and they help me do things in pediatric patients. We have nurse practitioners and physician's assistants and nurses who are gatekeepers. They're also the ones answering the phones if something isn't right and quickly escalate this to us. We have people who do what's called neuromonitoring. This is making sure that when we're doing brain and spine surgery, that the communications between the brain and whatever we're operating on are still there, because that can actually allow us to stop before we cause long-term harm. I have a physician assistant that supports me. I have my own pediatric neurosurgery nurse that supports me, and that's outside of the OR. In the OR, there's a couple teams that are so fortunate to have their own nursing staff, meaning that these are specially trained nurses who, when I put my hand out, sometimes I don't say the right thing and they give me the right thing that I want anyways. We operate under a microscope sometimes, and so they can't see the field anymore, but there's a screen that they're watching. They are part of the operation, watching our every move and know what are the things that we need. So they're indispensable to our efficiency, to our patient safety, and just overall function. And then we have all these other ancillary services that we don't exist without. And so for the example of Kian and his AVM, he had one of our neurointerventional radiologists, Dr. Johnson, do an embolization of his AVM first. Basically, one of the big pumping vessels feeding this thing, he blocked off for me. So my job was made easy because someone did some of the operative work before I even got in there. So he did great before care. There's also team members that are in charge of aftercare. If somebody has a tumor, for example, a lot of tumors aren't just like, take it out, high five, you're cured. There's other chemotherapies and radiations. It's a really complicated layered system, and I'm really excited to be a part of it. We actually have a lot of features here in our small rural area. We are small and mighty.
You're the only pediatric neurosurgeon in Vermont. What drew you to this work, and what's the experience been like of being the only one?
The short version is I actually didn't want to be a surgeon. I didn't want the lifestyle. And then I got an exposure to it. And then I just kept asking and opening doors and just kind of looking and exploring. And I found my way into neurosurgery, which that in of itself was like, holy moly. I grew up in a small town in Northwest Ohio. There was literally an OBGYN and a family doc in my hometown. My parents took us to the pediatrician, which was 45 minutes away, to even find a pediatrician specialist. So that was just super cool. And then during residency, I had some very key exposures to kids that came in who were sick. You thought these kids were going to die. And they walked out of the hospital a week or two or 3 weeks later. And so just this incredible, unquantifiable healing potential of a pediatric patient blew my mind. And so putting together the neurosurgery and this intrinsic desire and ability to improve is what fueled me to become a pediatric neurosurgeon. Fortunately, through that 8 years of training from finishing medical school to finishing fellowship, I've crossed the paths of lots of different people. And so I have a list of friends that I phone. Some of my friends are old friends. Some of my friends are new friends. I pick and choose who I ask specific questions to, because some pediatric neurosurgeons are specialized in what they do. So they only do vascular. They only do surgery for craniosynostosis or funny shaped heads. And so if I have one of those really specific questions or a technique question, I'll ask this individual. So from a planning perspective, I'm never on an island. There's about 300 pediatric neurosurgeons in the country. I can't say that I know all of them, but I probably at least know of or have had a conversation with most of them. And then despite being the only one here, I have four fantastic partners that if anything goes sideways in the OR, doesn't matter if they're pediatric trained or adult trained, I have a second set of hands that's really always at beck and call. I also have residents, and so it's a 7-year program. The first year resident has the least experience, the chief resident has the most experience, and our two senior residents right now are really strong. And so having them too, of having training from my other partners and dealing with me with other hairy cases, we can usually work our way through most stuff. So between having physical helpers here and then having intellectual helpers all over the country, yeah, technically I'm alone, but I'm never alone.
You graduated from Larner College of Medicine, left to complete your fellowship, and practiced in Indiana before returning as the state's only pediatric neurosurgeon. What was it like making that transition?
The best part about the transition was I learned a bunch in Indiana. So I was there for 2.5 years. And they were a freestanding children's hospital, were a hospital in a hospital. And Indiana is a state of 7 million, were 750,000, catch about a million. And so I got to take some of those things from Indiana and bring them here. And we're really embraced with open arms. One of them, for example, is using a special kind of endoscope. So I can put it in someone's brain. And previously we only had one that was rigid. It was just a straight stick. And mine actually curves. It actually looks like an Umbra GI endoscope. So I can put it in someone's brain and look around corners. Super duper cool. I got to bring that here. When I showed up, I said, yep, I want this. So I have it and I'm using it probably in the next half an hour or so. I bet I use it once a month and it's one of my favorite tools to use. And it's got lots of different applications from treating hydrocephalus to taking tumor biopsies. The other example is concussion care sometimes is inconsistent in Vermont. And in Indiana, they had this fantastic concussion clinic. Half a day a week, run by a nurse practitioner. There were physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy, vestibular rehab, a neurologist, and a school teacher there. So I came back here and I said, great, I want one of these. I want to be brick and mortar, and I want CAT scan access to it. And I kind of got laughed at, like, yeah, you're not getting any of these things. But the Children's Hospital is great. And so they gave me a woman by the name of Kathy. Kathy was one of the quality partners, and she arranged a bunch of Zoom meetings. And so every 2 to 4 weeks, we'd get together with Kathy, my clinic nurse, and then some people from rehab therapy. And we came up with this option of a virtual clinic, and that we get a referral from primary care doctors, ER docs. And after a couple days, my nurse will give the family and the patient a call, see how they're doing. And if they were still having symptoms, send them to physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy, or neurology. We didn't get to examine them. So that was definitely a bit of a downfall, but it meant that people were getting resources and they were getting to things pretty quickly. And that was very COVID-y when this all happened. And so we're actually saving families a trip from coming in. Susie's not sleeping well. She's not performing well in school. Based on these symptoms, you should probably go to occupational therapy. And we would actually follow these out. And those who were still symptomatic at the time of the call, which is only about a week after the concussion, were getting up to an average of 8 therapy sessions. And so these were truly the symptomatic patients. And these were pediatric patients only. I extended my number up to about age 22 to catch the college kids here who oftentimes didn't have a PCP. And it's been pretty successful. It was one of my first projects we started here, and it was published in a neurosurgery journal a couple of years ago.
What's the current scope of the need that you see across our region? And are there things that are developing or coming up next for pediatric neurosurgery that you're really excited about?
I'm a bit of a generalist, and in a lot of specialties, it's going away. There's no space to have more than one of me here. And so I pick up most of the things. And the most common thing that I treat is something called hydrocephalus. And that's treated with either putting a surgically implanted tube into someone's brain or using my fancy flexible endoscope and poking a really precise hole. I do a lot of Chiari surgery. That's having an abnormality in the back of your skull where your brain pooches out a little bit and patients can be very symptomatic. I do a fair amount of surgery for brain tumors and sometimes spinal cord tumors as well. It's not a super busy thing, but it's probably on the range of one a month or so. And sometimes they're really straightforward and sometimes they're really complicated, which is why having that neuromonitoring team that I mentioned earlier has allowed us to do really big operations and keep people local. I do craniosynostosis surgery. That is abnormally grown together bones of the skull, and that can be done both open and endoscopically. And we are doing endoscopic craniosynostosis surgery here too, and also something I got to bring from Indiana. So that was a big win. I have a couple of special places in my heart. One of them is cerebrovascular surgery, and so doing pediatric AVMs. And then lastly, something that we're really trying to grow is eventually doing pediatric epilepsy surgery. That is in very much infancy, and we're talking about it, but hopefully we'll continue to talk about it and continue to grow and find some resources for it. Having epilepsy, having uncontrolled seizure activity, is anything from inconvenient to devastating. And up to a third of patients with epilepsy have medically refractory epilepsy, meaning after doing a trial of 2 medications, and that doesn't seem like a big number, but once you've hit 2 medications and you're still having seizures despite them being appropriately chosen and well-dosed, your likelihood of having seizure freedom is less than 10%. And so your likelihood of having improvement with surgery is higher than that. And we're really not doing any of that now in the pediatric or the adult realm. And that's one of the reasons I became a pediatric neurosurgeon. I remember being my 5th year residency and seeing a kid who had one diseased hemisphere and one non-diseased hemisphere, who had pretty frequent seizures, underwent something called a hemispherectomy. There is no more invasive operation than literally cutting someone's brain in half. It sounds brutal. It is brutal. But the kid woke up and didn't have seizures anymore. And it was incredible. If he stays seizure free, it means instead of his brain seizing all the time, his brain can actually learn things. And people just grow and flourish and develop after their seizures stop. So it's exciting. I'm passionate about it. It's been definitely a void that's been here. And if it shows up here, I will be eternally fulfilled.
That's all the time we have today on Living Healthy Together. Thanks to all our guests for being with us and sharing their stories and insights. If you're out there listening and have a question, comment, or idea for a future episode, email us at healthtalk@uvmhealth.org. Living Healthy Together is also available as a podcast. If you're interested in checking out some of our past episodes, look us up wherever you listen to podcasts. Be sure to follow, subscribe, and consider giving us that 5-star rating, which really helps a lot. I'm your host, Philip Rao. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.